You're doing comfrey?
Yeah. Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. Hope you all had a fantastic 4th of July weekend. Here we are after a rainy, rainy Monday to a beautiful, unusually cool Tuesday. And here we are live in the KHOI studios. I'm here. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And we are the Danilana Kitchen. We get together and talk about just about anything that you can talk about around a kitchen table, including food. We like food. Hope you had a good Independence Day weekend. And speaking of independence, I've been kind of keeping my ear to the ground, keeping up on what's going on in Greece currently. I wish those people well. I remember that Independence Day weekend is to celebrate the fact that about 250 years ago, we were doing the same thing, throwing off tyranny and unfair taxation and all that sort of thing. So more power to all the folks. We'll see how that plays out. Well, Donna, what did you do this weekend?
I had a new toy for Fourth of July.
Good.
I bought one of those ice shaver machines. We had talked about them last week, and so I went on eBay and got one, and, you know, we plugged it in. It went to two different parties, and we had lots of experiments. So we made adult snow cones and children's snow cones, and everybody seemed to really enjoy it. So, the difference is, of course, I did not buy the syrups. I made my own syrups. So the 4th of July, we did the red one and the blue one. The red was, oh, boy. I mean, I went through the freezer and pulled out every bit of berries that I had in there. So the blueberry one had black currants and blueberries and also the cassis, you know, which is the black currant. I didn't put enough liquor in it that the kids couldn't have it. And it didn't turn their tongues blue because there were no additives in it. But it did make a lot of T-shirts have fruit stains down the front. And then the red one was, I think I went raspberries, cherry, strawberry, and I think even a little cranberry to make it redder.
Uh-huh.
And I sweetened them both with one I sweetened with flat out wildflower honey, kind of, you know, very neutral. Clover honey, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one I sweetened with agave syrup. I mean, of course, I could have made my own sugar syrup, but I was into kind of just throwing things together and mixing and experimenting. And then the adult ones had, there were two different ones. One I made like I took white wine, orange juice concentrate, and a little orange what are one of those, you know, like Cointreau kind of thing. So I just made a mixture out of that. And so it was kind of like I didn't want to do margarita slushy. That would be the norm. So I did a slushy out of that one. And then the other one I made like a syrup with my coriander syrup, which is just coriander crushed in the blender with sugar strained and heated. Not in that order. Heated, then strained, right? And I added some cherry juice to that and just a splash of bourbon. Not enough to make like a regular cocktail, but to give it that bourbon flavor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I poured that over the crushed ice. And that was really – and there are numbers of wild, creative things that one could do with that shaved ice. And it was lots of fun.
Are you pleased with this? You said you looked up online and there was all kinds of – crush ice machines. Are you pleased with the one that you bought?
I just went for the, you know, El Cheapo plastic one. And I think
El Cheapo's good.
Well, you know, it's not going to be a major. I mean, I looked at, of course, there were beautiful ones for professional ice cream, ice makers, like at bars and stuff like $160 or something. But I bought something it was $40 delivered, I think. And, you know,
Is this an electric thing? Or
And I did buy the one where you can just use ice cubes. You know, some of them you had to freeze these little cylinders in the freezer. And I thought, no, that's not going to be you know, that takes too much forethought.
Right. That's something to look for. So there's all kinds of varieties out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And about serving these things, you didn't bother with the little paper cones, did
Well,
you?
Actually, the kit came with a few.
Oh, okay.
So for the children, I used those, you know, that kind
little
of
paper cone.
Yeah, yeah. And the rest of it, I just served in glasses and cups and whatever, you know, with a spoon.
And your guests were glad to have them.
Actually, everybody loved it. It was the right temperature. We did have good weather on the 4th of July. Amazing weather, actually.
Beautiful weather. Yes. What a nice weekend.
What a perfect 4th of July. Yes.
Oh, I want to take the opportunity to mention that this whole radio experience is a volunteer operation, and we appreciate all the help and goodwill and support that we get from the community. And here's support from one of our underwriters.
Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocer in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Ah. So, this weekend, besides the 4th of July, we had, on my farm, we pulled up our garlic.
This was a major community deal.
Oh, my goodness. We have a lovely garlic crop this year. And thank you to all the fine folks that came out. Because it's been such a lush, green, wonderful year, I can't say that digging up the garlic was hard, but one did need a garden fork to get those out of the ground, and they're big and they're lovely and knocking the dirt off. It was a lot of fun.
So when you're digging in to pull the – how deep down is the bulb? Like 6 inches?
About 6 inches, yeah. Yeah, because we mulched on top of that, uh-huh. and that kind of you know, had gone down by now. They were quite down there, I'd say, although
– So the mulch on the top is still fairly loose soil.
Sort of, although we've had so much rain. I can't say it was compact and awful, but it was a challenge to get them up.
It was a dig, huh?
And it was so nice to have kind of waves of people show up. It was a nice – it had to be a hot summer day to do it. So they showed up with the garden forks and dug and dug and dug. And long about the end, after you dig all this stuff up and get all the dirt off of it and wheelbarrow it out of the field – and actually, I lay it on the flatbed of our truck because it's a nice place to work on it. Then one needs to sort it and kind of clean it off and bunch it in bunches.
What are you sorting for?
Oh, because every now and then, even the best of us put a fork right through one of these, and so if any heads are damaged, we set those aside. Or if there's any really small, kind of funky looking thing, but those go into a pile, and those are called kitchen garlic. They're fine to eat. They're just not really pretty. So we had lots.
Do they have to be eaten more quickly if they've been pierced?
Yeah, not. I mean, they won't last till Christmas. Okay, they're not going to dry. They're not going to dry down well. The rest of these we want them to dry. They'll hang in a barn for about a month.
So how long of a stem is still on the garlic when you've pulled it?
This year is green and lovely. The whole
3 feet,
thing.
Huh?
Oh, 3 feet, 4 feet. We had big, tall garlic, so that stays on.
So that's a good thing to tie it with.
That's a good thing. No, I use binder twine. I bunch them.
Five in a bundle
because that's kind of the weight that I want to deal with. Mm-hmm. And unless they're really small, then I just put a bunch of little ones together and tie it off and leave two long ends on my tie. And those ties will be what I hang them up in the barn with. So luckily, all these nice people came and dug. And they got the stuff out of the field. And then long about when I had this huge, huge pile to tie up, a whole bunch of high school kids showed up. I didn't know any of them, and they just showed up with their teachers. And
oh, is that from the sort of ag program that's going on at the local high school?
I think
farm?
So.
Fantastic.
I don't know. They just sort of tumbled down the hill, and I said, "Here's how you tie them. You tie them tight, and you tie them with long ends on." And it was lovely because everybody grabbed onto one part of the process. We got it all laid onto a hay wagon, and luckily everything got backed into our shed out of the rain because as soon as all that stuff was under cover, it rained. So
it's now like laying on the truck.
No, and yesterday, after the rain, next process. This is a long process. Next process. We take it out of, we took this hay wagon and drove it up to next to the barn that we store it in, and we parked underneath the hay mow door, which is a story up. And people, everybody does this different, but we have a setup that here's this whole great big pile of tied up bundles. I go up to the, actually, we had fun. We had some relatives had come and help us too. So thank you, Jim and Libby. They helped us. I was up in the barn looking through
the
door.
What are you doing? Crawling around in the rafters?
No, not that high. On the floor of the barn loft. And Jim and Joe were on the hay wagon. Libby and I were up in the window, and with a little bit of practice, they can toss, we can catch. They can toss, we can catch. Catch, toss, catch. And you get the whole pile of garlic up in the barn. That's how it works.
Is it hanging?
Not yet, but it will be. It is all spread out and drying. And so, phew.
Give me a visual. How many bundles of five do you think you have?
About 700.
700 bundles of five?
Yeah. We had a good year, Donna. This was an unusually good year. So
That's not a small production.
And I hope everybody else has a good garlic year too, because it looks like we'll have some good. Now it still has to dry. Well, I mean, it's very usable now, but it still has to dry and cure. So it does keep.
So how long does it dry and cure?
At least a month and even longer. But like I said, you can use the garlic right now. But.
And when do you have to tie the strings up and make it hang?
Oh, I'll be doing that on and off all week to kind of.
Is that just to keep the critters out of
no,
it?
No, just keep the air moving.
Circulation?
Keep the air circulating. Also, we need the barn floor for other things.
Well, I have to say.
Hanging it up is the next thing.
Onion Creek Farm grows really, really good garlic.
So we are going to have
a bounty. Yeah. No vampires this year.
Woo-hoo. Three cheers for garlic this year.
Oh, boy. Well, that's exciting.
Yes.
And now remind me again, when did you plant this?
I plant mine long about Halloween, end of October, mm-hmm. 1st of mm-hmm. November. So it sleeps over the winter. It grows in the spring. It grows in the summer. Remember garlic scapes? They happened about three weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And now, ta-da, here we are, garlic season. So
now another month of harvesting, or a drying, and then it will be for sale at the farmer's market.
You betcha.
And I'm going to, what I like to do is take a huge supply. And the variety that you grow usually has quite large cloves, which I'm hoping is true, of course, this year. And I peel them down and freeze them whole.
That works out really well.
Yeah, it does. And I have seen people also freeze them without peeling them. Hmm. And then obviously you peel them when you...
Peel them later.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
Ha! Good.
Well, wonderful. We've got a lot of garlic to look forward to.
Three cheers for garlic. It is that season. I want to mention we have an herb of the week this week. I want to talk a little bit about comfrey. If you are blessed with a comfrey crop, there's lots of things you can do with it besides badmouth it, because it does spread and it takes over things, and you do have to keep it in check.
How does it spread? Mine never spreads. I have one comfrey plant moves.
You must have, there is one variety that is bred to be sterile, and the seeds do not reseed. Unfortunately, I must have a wilder variety.
I actually would like mine to spread I'm going to come and get some of your seeds.
If you want yours to spread, you can spread it by breaking the roots apart and doing it. It grows from the roots, grows from the tap root very, very well. So if you want to spread that or move that variety, cut it up, break the roots up a little bit, and spread it. It'll go like gangbusters.
Well, where do you keep yours that spreads, and how do you contain it?
I don't. I whack away at it. It's, let's see. Any place that I can mow it, I mow it. But it's kind of in some garden beds around my pond. It's a wonderful bee plant. It's a wonderful plant. You can use it for a lot of different things.
I think it's – I love it, actually.
Oh, it's beautifully.
It's got these big, fuzzy leaves.
Big, fuzzy leaves and beautiful flowers. But I try to at least cut off the flowers this time of year so I don't have them all over the place. But it comes back up again. It's fine.
It does take a lot of sun, right?
It grows just about any place. It loves the sun, but it grows any old place.
Do you think it would grow in the shade?
Oh, yeah. Mine does.
Could I put it under that willow tree Give it a try. All right. I'm coming out to get some seeds.
Yes.
So what do you do with all your comfrey besides look at it?
What do I – believe it or not, it's a fast-growing plant, and it's a wonderful thing to add to your compost heap and use as fertilizer. It's really, really high in potash and a lot of other minerals. It's amazing stuff. You can use it as a compost activator to put in your compost, and it composts down to this wonderful – I shouldn't say wonderful. It's very disgusting, slimy mess, but that stuff is intensely great in stuff that your garden needs, and it helps the compost,
For example, if I were to plant a bunch of it and have a big crop next year, in the fall, if I chopped it down and spread it around on my other beds, would that compost in?
That is an excellent idea. The leaves
are
great
to mulch. Boy, that sounds like an easy way to deal.
Yes. I've read some things that you're supposed to let it dry a little bit first, but who's going to get around to that? I just use those big, fat, hairy leaves as mulch for other things. Feed a little bit to the chickens, but you can kind of over OD on that. It's really high in vitamins, but you don't want to give them a lot all at once.
You can eat it.
Yes. And there's recommendations that don't eat a lot all at once. It is good for you, but it is pretty strong stuff.
Because it's highly mineralized?
Yeah,
is that
right,
why?
Right. And you can make comfrey tea out of it, which means let the leaves rot, run some water through it, and use that as a fertilizer.
Let them rot?
Well, yeah, in some sort of container.
You mean comfrey tea fertilizer.
Comfrey tea fertilizer.
Yeah, because I'm thinking comfrey. Because you could make comfrey tea. You could just pour some hot water and steep and drink it. And it's also very good for a poultice, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't it? Mm-hmm. For bruising or what's it for?
What's amazing is that comfrey has been called, let me get this right here. It's called knit bone or bone set.
And the comfrey is bone set?
Is bone set, yes. It was reported to have to help bone and teeth properties. It is.
Must be the minerals.
In the molecule that is in it is called allotonin, which is thought to stimulate cell growth and repair bones while also depressing inflammation.
Sounds like I better be having a cup of tea of comfrey every morning.
Comfrey is one of those amazing garden plants that take over, but it's one of those titans of the garden. So I like to watch my comfrey fight with my other big plants like comfrey and rhubarb and tansy and, they're big plants. And they kind of shoulder their way along.
Well, I have to say it's one of the few things I have managed to plant and not kill. It comes up every year
and
for the last 8 or 9 years, and I can count on it.
And it's pretty.
You can do things like chop a little into salads. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, it does have these hairy leaves, kind of, but they're not. They're just different texture. They're not that unpleasant.
For some people, you might want to use gloves to handle it because those little pickly. It's kind of like the pickly leaves of a cucumber. That kind of cucumber vine or squash vine. It is a little irritating to some folk. But
oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's
well,
okay.
I don't have any trouble with it.
Yeah.
And also,
fine.
People do things like steam it down and pack it in ravioli, for example. I mean,
I've never heard of that. That's a great idea.
I think that's a little, I mean, it doesn't have a terribly distinct flavor.
Yeah,
it goes
yeah.
in my book with zucchinis, which are another thing that some people love, and I'm going, oh, it's so bland. But it is, that's a good reminder, Lana. I think I'm going to start drinking some comfrey tea.
It's supposed to be good. You can make tea out of it, and it's also supposed to be good for your skin. Comfrey hair rinse, or put a little in your bath.
Well, and that's why it does make a good poultice on an abrasion or a, that kind of thing.
Good. Another thing I want to mention is that we have a moon sort of thing to celebrate this month of July. The 1st of July was the new moon, and we noticed last week that it was really orange.
The orange moon. The reason the orange polka dot in the sky.
Yeah, because of all the forest fires, the smoke in the sky. So we're going to start this month with an orange moon. But believe it or not, and this doesn't have to do with the color, but the moon at the end of the month, the last day of the month, is going to be called the blue moon. And because not often do you have two full moons in one month, but it just so happens July has a blue moon in it.
A second moon.
And hence the saying once in a blue moon, which means not very often. So we will have two full moons this week. I want to mention that you're listening to KHOI, Heart of Iowa Radio. This is community radio. We're going to listen to a little music here about that old blue moon.
Is this it?
Try one.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, "Please adore me." And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, "Please adore me." And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
So we're back, and we're going to have an interview with Joseph Beekler and Fred Kirschman, and I talking about carbon sequestration. Joseph is a young man who is originally from Ames. We had his brother Peter on last week. The Beekler boys are quite active in the food world, the food and ag world. So Joseph is an agronomist, and he is working for a company called the Carbon Underground. It's actually an NGO. It's in Costa Rica. And the main purpose of the Carbon Underground is actually to communicate about the issues of carbon sequestration, which are quite exciting if you're in the mind to be saving our precious planet. I think the Pope might be interested in hearing about this.
Probably.
Oh, by the way, did you see the Pope has invited Naomi Klein to join him in these discussions about
climate change?
Yeah.
And oh, for goodness sakes.
We could say the Pope is really serious, because Naomi Klein is no nonsense. Her most well-known book is The Shock Doctrine, where she talks about basically how governments kind of do shock and awe, and then the population is so befuddled and endangered and frightened, and then these tactics are used to drive in, like, surveillance methods, among other things. And then her latest book, which I can't remember the title, is all about global warming and how dire it really
is.
Well,
we have to think about this sort of thing. The idea of carbon sequestration is there's too much carbon in the atmosphere right now, and we better start doing things to get it out
of
the atmosphere.
Well, it's interesting because there have been all kinds of, you know, sci-fi constructed fixes for this. You know, how we're going to we'll put an aluminum or reflective shield around the whole globe, or we'll all colonize in space somewhere or something like this. But it turns out that we have significant science showing that certain farming practices, not too difficult, most of them are simply organic and cover cropping and things like that, can actually take the carbon in a natural cycle out of the air and put it back into the soil.
Now,
so that is called
carbon
sequestration.
Well, good. Let's hear this interview.
So it's Fred Kirschemann from the Leopold Center and Joseph Beekler and myself with Lana recording. And here we go. Okay, so tonight in my living room, we have the pleasure of having Fred Kirschemann and Joseph Beekler. Now, Joseph is actually living and working in Costa Rica, but he's an Iowa farm boy from just north of Ames. So we're going to talk about carbon sequestration. So, Joseph, you want to explain the quick and dirty what carbon sequestration is?
Yeah, absolutely. Carbon sequestration, to put it simply, is taking carbon or CO2 out of our atmosphere and putting it back in the soil in stable forms that will hold it there in the soil for a long time.
And this is to mitigate climate change, right?
Our goal is to mitigate climate change, and we are seeing really positive results that point to that, actually pretty conclusive stuff coming out now. And just to clarify, that there's a lot of talk happening about carbon sequestration through mechanical means and through natural means. And we're focusing
mostly agricultural means, right?
Right, exactly. We're talking about photosynthesis. It goes back to photosynthesis, how plants take CO2, use it in their own processes, and trade those carbon sugars, those carbohydrates, with the microorganisms in the soil, and how those microorganisms fix it in stable forms, which is a whole lot cheaper and simpler than mechanically putting carbon underneath the soil. So,
Fred, do you want to give us the quick view of how this is going to affect our long-term future?
Well,
this is Fred Kirschemann.
You know, what we need to be thinking about is our grandchildren, right? What kind of world
are we
going to...
At the very least.
What kind of world are we going to leave for them? And, you know, I know we still have some people that are, you know, climate deniers, but the evidence is overwhelming now. And if we don't begin to address this issue, and the International Panel on Climate Change has now told us we only have about 15 years to get this turned around, because we now, just this year now, we reached 400 parts per million on a global basis.
Which we didn't want to pass, but
right,
there we are already.
Yeah. Well, and all the scientists have said we need to get to 350, so we actually have to bring it down. So we have to now, within the next 15 years, really address this. And I think, you know, that not that agriculture can solve all of this problem, but it plays a very key role. Because right now, our agriculture is contributing to the problem for the most part, because the way in which we're doing agriculture is putting more carbon into the environment, and what we need to do is turn that around and have agriculture begin to sequester.
So give us a little quick example in Iowa what corn and soybean producers could actually be doing that would put the carbon back into the soil.
Well, the key issue here is to develop soil health. Because if you have, I mean, soil, you know, we still have a lot of public perception out there that soil is just dirt, and it's not. Soil is a living community. There are more living organisms beneath the surface of the soil than there are above the surface of the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So by enhancing the health of that living community is what then creates the kind of soil which begins to sequester carbon instead of extending in the universe.
So for example, cover crops.
Well, you know, cover crops can play a role. So But so first of all, the core thing is restoring the biological health of our soil. And then in addition to that, what we want to do is have more green growing crops on our fields.
All the time.
Right. And so if you have a monoculture corn-soybean operation, you've got green growing crops for what? 4 months out of the year, right? If you add cover crops, you can have 8 months out of the year of green growing crops. And then ultimately, in the longer term future, we need to think about more perennials, because if you have perennials with perennial root systems, then you dramatically increase the sequestration of the carbon into the soil.
Well, now you're working in Costa Rica, so you can probably grow things year-round down there. Is that advancing your research faster? Tell me what you're doing.
Okay. What we're looking at is basically we're looking for the best management practices in organics, and not only organics, but regenerative agriculture is what we like to call it. Mm-hmm. The best management practices to sequester carbon. And a lot of those principles are the same here in temperate climates. The only difference being we have 12 months of the year versus here, best management, you might get 8-9 months out of the year. And so we're looking at cover cropping systems, looking at perennial cropping, looking at composting, really increasing that interrelationship that the microorganisms have with the roots of our plants. Looking at the rotations, how we rotate plants through and diversify, making sure we're not doing monocultures, that sort of thing. And looking at how we can increase root systems, interactions between the microorganisms in the soil to sequester carbon. And Fred, you know, brought up an interesting point earlier that that this is part of the solution, that agriculture has to contribute to that. And I want to highlight just the role that agriculture can play in the solution to climate change, in mitigating climate change.
A big one.
Currently, it is the biggest if you take into transportation, processing, and the actual growing. It is the biggest contributor to greenhouse gas in our atmosphere. But at that same point, if we optimize it to best management practices and we get the numbers that we are seeing through different grazing management practices and through different crop management, through cover cropping and composting and that relationship, it can reverse climate change.
Okay. We're seeing. But now the systems that you're working in are all organic and even biodynamic. So there are a lot of things you are not doing.
Right. There are a lot of things that we are not doing.
Yeah.
We're doing minimal tilling, minimal disruption of our soil, because a disturbance has set us back in ecological succession, which can be important in setting us forward, but if it's a constant disturbance, it just sets us all the way back. So there are several things. That's one of the things we're not doing. We're not applying synthetic chemicals, fertilizers,
No glyphosate,
no pesticides. I want to highlight that on our best management, but we always compare this to our control, which are conventional fields.
Oh, so you do have some conventional fields, so right. It's really a scientific study.
Right, exactly. So we play both roles. We play the good guys and we play the bad guys. We do all of our agriculture to what we call Monsanto's best management practices.
Oh.
And to help make sure that we're on that, one of our advising scientists is Dr. Peter Raven, who advises Monsanto. And so we always refer back to him. Is this a best management practice for big ag?
So this is very serious science.
Yeah, we want to make sure that when we publish things that they can't come in and say, well, no, we referred back to the big ag industry.
Good.
This is. So, but we're seeing results in a lot of these studies, not only from within our own internal studies, which we're yet to publish. We're looking at an October date. We're seeing results of 9 tons of carbon per hectare per year, all the way up to 30 tons of carbon per hectare a year. And I just want to do a quick calculation, if you guys will indulge me, on what 9 tons of carbon per hectare means.
Yeah.
Okay.
Paint a picture here.
If we optimized all of our agricultural land currently in production to sequester 9 tons of carbon per hectare per year.
And that's your lower number, right?
That's our lower number. And the things that we're looking at are pointing to, that's bare bones. That's not really changing a whole lot, okay? what we're looking at here is with 9 tons of carbon per hectare per year, we're looking at, if we calculate that out, it takes 2 tons of carbon to, it takes 2 gigatons of carbon to remove one part per million CO2 from our atmosphere. So if we multiply that out by, what's our number is I think it's 13 billion hectares right now of farm ground. We multiply that out, and we get in 10 years enough carbon sequestered out of or sequestered from our atmosphere to put us down to from 400 parts per million to 242 parts per million greenhouse gas.
Well, that would make Bill McKibben very happy, wouldn't it?
It would make Bill McKibben. And Bill McKibben has been a cut emissions. Mm-hmm. And he's now starting to turn to, oh, wait, sequestration is the way. That this is the future. 242 in 10 years, we're back below pre-industrial times. We reverse. And Fred just mentioned, we've got about 15 years. Let's jump on board. This is easy. We get 30. We just need a third of the crop ground. You know.
All right. So your research is under the an NGO called the Carbon Underground, right?
Correct.
And Tom Newmark is the founder of that. Exactly. Now, who else is doing this research? Rodale? Aren't they doing some research?
Yeah, too? We are partnered with the Rodale Institute. We're partnered with IFOAM. That's IFOAM. That's the International Federation on Organic Agricultural Movements. And they have some trials running over mm-hmm. in Europe mm-hmm. and in South America, mm-hmm. And as well as one in Egypt, I think. And so we're all comparing data. There's another group in Thailand, and I apologize.
Tell the Pope about this yet?
I haven't told the Pope
yet.
Well,
let's get on with it. He's on our side now.
He's on our side. I'll be honest, I'm more of an in-the-lab kind of guy, mm-hmm. and Tom Newmark is the face.
Tom will call the Pope. Okay.
Tom's the face.
Yeah, and I think the Dalai Lama got on endorsing the Pope today.
I heard that as well.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
It's snowballing.
It's a spiritual, hitting, ethical matter of our time.
Exactly, and we're hitting critical mass. Mm-hmm. We're hitting critical mass. Mm-hmm. It's starting to change. So.
Sometimes we feel that we can't do anything. This is an amazing thing that you are studying the data that people affecting farms, farming, just farming differently, farming more sustainably. You have data to prove that, by goodness, it would make a difference.
And the byproduct is we get better soil, right?
Exactly, better soil. We get better food. We get better health. You know, we start looking at these. One of the things that we need to do better is true cost accounting of what is the actual.
And we get better tasting food.
And we get better tasting food. Exactly. But it just all snowballs into this mm-hmm. one big beneficial result that is really hope inspiring, I think. And it's almost frustrating because we have so much data already, and it's ready, and it, you know, pays.
Fred, well, can you make this happen?
Well, you know, that's the thing. I think that one of the big barriers that we have in front of us is that we have to make a cultural change, because right now we're kind of focused on this that we've got to maintain the maximum material growth, economic growth, in order to generate jobs, and, you know, so everything is about what Paul Roberts calls the mine and now culture. You know,
we could have more farmers. That's a job.
Well, but the thing is, you know, right? We're still having people say we got too many farmers, because, you know, the more farmers you got, the more farmers you have to support. Well, if you had less farmers, well, then you can have more profit for everybody in the system, right? That's how the culture.
The bottom line.
The culture does this, and so cultural changes are always difficult. And but I think that you know, everything that we're talking about here, we're rapidly now reaching a point where the current system's just not going to work anymore. So the important thing now is for us all to work together to demonstrate there is another way to do this that has all of these other benefits.
Yeah, we've figured it out already, haven't we?
Right.
Actually?
Yeah, exactly. And then when it gets to the point where it doesn't work anymore, then we can see these shifts take place pretty quickly. Now, that's not to say that there aren't a lot of businesses, not only the farmers, but the input suppliers, the food processors, the retailers. They've all made huge investments in this current system and the infrastructure for this current system, so they're going to do everything they can to keep the current system going. And we have to simply recognize that that's simply a rational reality on their part. But again, when it doesn't work anymore, even they are going to have to make the changes. So it's important for us to have the kinds of examples that you've talked about, so that we know there's another way to do this. And that's the important thing to be doing now.
Could you tell me more about how the Carbon Underground started?
Okay. Yeah, that was a really interesting meeting. It started when I went to Costa Rica and started working on the farm I currently work on. I have a background in soil ecology, soil microbiology, a specialty in organic composting, and met with the owner of this farm, Tom Newmark, and he was talking to me about, hey, I want to do this research. Could you do this research? I said, yeah, let's start it. Let's keep going. And then we had a conversation with one of his friends, Larry Copald, and they were saying, we need an NGO that does more outreach, that, you know, supports the research, but does.
And you know. Larry Copald is an old friend of mine from Hollywood. He started something called the Earth Communications Office. Right. So he's quite skilled at this environmental NGO business.
Yes. If anybody can communicate, it's Larry Copal. Mm-hmm. So we all sat together, and Tom and Larry said, you know, we're going to start an NGO that will not only support research, but also bring in the activism, connect with the policymakers to help bring about this, the change that needs to happen in agriculture.
How long has this been going on? When did it get started?
2 years. Mm-hmm, the Carbon Underground is 2 years old. And we're just going full tilt right now. So
sounds like a wonderful, positive thing. If someone wants to find out more about the Carbon Underground, how would they do that?
Thecarbonunderground.org.
There you go. Google the Carbon Underground.
Yep.
Did you have any specific questions that you wanted to ask Fred?
Yeah, I think it would be great to know, with your experience and number of years in the field, where do you see the lack of knowledge lying, and where do we need to focus the next or the upcoming research? Where are we lacking knowledge, or where do we need to focus our activism and direct our policy?
Well, that's a great question, and I've always said it's not a lack of knowledge. You know, we've had individuals ever since we've been moving in this direction in agriculture toward what some people call an industrial agriculture, some people call it a high input agriculture, whatever you want to call it. The modern agriculture system now is entirely dependent on inputs to make it work. And ever since that, we've been moving in that direction, going back to, Justus von Liebig, who did the research, which first came to the conclusion, as he said, we don't have to worry about the laborious process of restoring the biological health of the soil anymore, because all we need to do is put these synthetic inputs that he discovered, you know, the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash, and then you can produce the yields, etc. Well, there were people from the beginning that said this is the wrong direction. You know, you had Sir Albert Howard, mm-hmm. who referred to that as the NPK mentality. And he, in fact, referred to that as a form of banditry because it was going to steal healthy soil from future generations. You had Liberty Hyde Bailey, who said we had to have a new hold because this was the wrong direction. We had to change from the inside out and realize we had to move in the direction you're mm-hmm. talking about. You had Ole Leopold. I mean, there were a number of people throughout that history that are there that tell us and have demonstrated to us there is another way to do this. So it's not lack of knowledge in terms of actually what we need to do. What we are lacking is how to take that knowledge now and marry it with the science of ecology and evolutionary biology, and we've barely done any of that. And so mostly what we're doing now is taking that knowledge and individual farmers applying it, and this is not at all to say that that's not important. It is. But if we also began to look at how the science of ecology and evolutionary biology could inform that wisdom from the past, then we could make enormous strides into the future. And that's something that, unfortunately, you know, our land-grant universities have not been doing. We've not had other, educational systems that have really addressed that. But again, my view is that the current system, because it's so dependent on all of these energy inputs, And those costs are going to go up, and they already are. And, you know, we now know that in the United States, as an example, we only have about 20 years of phosphate reserves left. Yep. So that's going to be gone. The Ogallala Aquifer only has water reserves in it for another 20 years. So if you, and in 20 years from now, our fossil fuel energy costs probably are going to be around $300 a barrel. So if you start to think about all of that, you know, the changes are going to come fast.
Right, yes.
And so that's why we need to, you know, recapture this wisdom from the past and then take the science of ecology and evolutionary biology, and then we can create, we can design the future food system and agriculture system. And again, there the beauty of all of this is that we have individual farmers, and what you're doing in Costa Rica, you know, are examples that you can do this. And so it's no longer a question of, well, this is just theory. You know, it's not. It's practical stuff.
I would just want to add one more thing that I think Fred would agree with. Because you have this NGO called the Carbon Underground, and because you do have not only the research capacity, but you also have the communications capacity, having largely a very Hollywood-oriented board of directors. And Fred has talked about this a lot, ag arts, where you use the arts to communicate about agricultural issues, because now you're an Iowa farm boy, Fred's a Nebraska farm boy, you understand these things, but the majority of people who need to understand these things, if we're going to have any future at all, do not have the kind of language that you have. And that's where somebody like Larry Kopold's skill, it originally was the Earth Communications Office. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, 20, 25 years ago. It's really important to take this research and have Larry and his ilk put it into a cinematic format and say, hey, folks, we got a few really, really good ideas. I think you're very well positioned for that.
Yeah, I'm actually glad you said that, because we work very closely with a man named Peter Bick, who actually is faculty at Arizona State. And Peter Bick put together a beautiful 10-minute film documentary called Soil Carbon Cowboys, about the rotational grazers, the mob grazers, the Alan Savory holistic management grazers, and how much carbon they are sequestrating, how much easier their life is, how productive their farms are. And he's got a new film coming out that the Carbon Underground has helped sponsored, called Carbon Nation, talking about...
Good one!
yeah, right. Talking about carbon farming. Uh-huh. The farmers around the United States that are focusing on soil carbon and how it's improved. It's one thing to come at it from the climate change aspect. It's another to come at it from how does it personally affect the farmer's way of life, his daily work schedule, his income, all of that. And so that new documentary is really touching. And that's going to be a longer documentary, not the 10-minute format.
Well, I noticed that the Carbon Underground also has Lynn Lear on the board of directors.
We also have Lynn Lear.
She is the wife of Norman Lear, whom I cooked for a long time. And I know that Lynn must be very excited about these projects. So I certainly hope you show her everything. And
she is on the same
get
page.
Get her fingers in that pie there.
She is with us 100%. She is.
Well, let's communicate about this. It's very exciting.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Pleasure.
Welcome back. This is the Don Alana Kitchen. That was a little piece of music also about Costa Rica. We were talking about the Carbon Underground work happening in Costa Rica. And that was music written by a fine musician named Mike Bell. That was called The Cloud Forest. And he wrote it about his trip to Costa Rica. It was a Barnall band playing that fine waltz. This is KHOI. You're listening to the Don Alana Kitchen. To find out more about us, go to KHOIFM.org. You can find the Don Alana Kitchen webpage there. And if you want to contact us about what you've heard or what you'd like to hear on this radio station on Don Alana Kitchen, go to khoiradio@gmail.com. Let us know what you think. So we've been finding out about carbon sequestration, and it's a good thing you got those folks together, Donna.
Well, I have to say it's one of the bright spots in the very depressing kind of end of the world as we know it scenario. And boy, do we need all the hope and all the help that we can get. And thanks to Fred and young men like Joseph Buechler, who are going to outlive certainly Lana and I, and they're going to have to deal with this stuff.
And it's nice to know that doing the right thing as far as farming is concerned, just kind of doing what is logically good for the earth, really is good for the earth. And yes, we are part of it all. Yes. Good interview, Donna. Good job.
Oh, I really enjoyed it.
Good. I want to mention that every now and then I like to haul out my pagan book of days just to kind of keep things on an even keel here. I have a guide to festival traditions and sacred days of the year, and I looked up today, July 7th. Today we celebrate the Roman festival of Consuela, commemorates the god of harvest.
The god of garlic harvest.
The garlic, yes, it presages good harvest also later in the month. Other things are coming on. And today is also the Feria Ancillarium, the Festival of the Handmaidens. Get this. This is the maid's day out when the maids of Rome were beyond the control of their mistresses. So, yes, women go out and celebrate. It's also a day to venerate the sacred fig trees and the goddess Juno. So if you don't have a reason to celebrate, that's one of them today. Also, celebrate the fact that there are things we can do to help our planet, help ourselves. Let's learn to do the right thing.
I have a pre-harvesting question. We certainly don't have fig trees here to celebrate, but what about tomatoes?
Oh, tomatoes.
When do you think they're coming?
There are tomatoes already at the farmer's market.
Yeah, but those are all hoop house.
Yeah,
and some
house,
of them
yeah.
look really gorgeous.
Yes.
But
yes.
I want to know when we get the real sun in the field ripened tomatoes this year. It's been a little chilly.
My tomatoes are pretty slow. I'd say some people look in 2 weeks, and sweet corn ought to be around the corner. Talking to Ray Olson. Ray Olson knows these things. He tells sell
all
sweet
right.
corn.
We will have a report next week on when to expect the full bounty of our Iowa gardens.
What's up? You've been listening to the Don Alana Kitchen. We'll go out with a little music by Patty Casey, a little summertime. You heard her earlier singing about the blue moon. My name's Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had Fine Engineering by Virat Duati. And you had an interview with Fred Kirchman and Joseph Buechler about carbon sequestration. So eat good food and enjoy life.
Oh, your daddy's rich. Mama's good looking. So hush, little baby, don't you cry. One of these mornings, you're gonna rise up singing. And then you'll spread your wings and take to the sky. But till that morning, there's nothing can harm you. With Mama and Daddy standing standing by.